Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for March 24. We are appearing via Zoom, and we're, because of technological issues, missing one of our judges who's on the panel, but I'll have the marshal introduce the panel at this point.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Johnson, Judge Smith, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Thank you. And as I mentioned, Judge John Smith is on the panel, and that's why we delayed for a bit. We suspect there's some technological issues that he's not able to join us, so he may join at some point. So if you see a judge pop up, it'll be Judge Smith. Otherwise, the way we would typically proceed in the absence of a judge who's on the panel and prepared otherwise for these cases is await his ability to listen to the oral arguments, and then we will confer with each other before making a decision at that point. So otherwise, the proceeding is pretty much as counsel. You should be familiar. You'll see the clock in a corner of your screen. Appellant will have 15 minutes, 15 minutes for a respondent, and then an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal if appellant counsel so chooses. No other recording is allowed. We do, and you probably saw that little notice that we are recording this proceeding, and it will be available on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours. And we do ask counsel to identify yourself when you proceed, because we will have that then in the record. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Anton Cheskis, on behalf of appellant Kerry McCoy, as personal representative for the estate of Terry McCoy. Prior to his murder, Terry McCoy and respondent Ruth Jerwicki entered into a written purchase agreement for the sale of Mr. McCoy's homestead. Respondent now seeks to benefit from that purchase agreement without being bound by most of its unambiguous terms. Since respondent failed to bring her specific performance action within 6 months of the ultimate closing date, the plain language of the purchase agreement precludes respondent from specific performance unless respondent can prove that the parties did not treat time of the essence or that enforcing the six-month limitation of remedies clause would be unconscionable. Both of these inquiries are questions of fact not appropriate for summary judgment. So appellants respectfully request that the specific performance order be overturned and that this case be remanded for an evidentiary hearing.
Mr. Cheskis, before you move on, I want to ask you a little bit about our standard of review. It appears that both counsel in your briefs did use a phrase similar to or analogous to, et cetera, summary judgment. And yet everybody concedes that this is an equitable cause of action or an equitable issue, specific performance, and we're proceeding via probate, which is generally considered a equitable statutory-based proceeding in most decisions, if not all decisions of a district court. And we have case law in civil actions, and I'm looking at Melrose Gate in particular, talks about the scenario where our standard review in a case of equity, summary judgment, may not be de novo, but abuse of discretion. And I'm just wondering if more so here is because we're dealing with a probate proceeding and there was not your traditional motions for summary judgment, albeit we do have the affidavits the court considered and evidence, including the contract itself. So Mr. Cheskis, I guess my question for you, given that, and you make an argument specifically, there's facts in dispute. It was an error to hold and make a decision absent an evidentiary hearing. And yet the Melrose Gate case, that seems to be the exact kind of scenario where abuse of discretion might be the standard, where there's disputed facts and the courts seem to apply an equitable analysis of those facts to render a decision. So my question is, do you have a thought on that? And most importantly, I guess, if it's an abuse of discretion, how does that change your client's argument and thought in terms of what our decision should be?
So I don't think it changes our analysis either way, Your Honor, because we were never allowed to present all of the facts. We didn't get an evidentiary hearing. We did not get an opportunity to cross-examine witnesses. We did not get an opportunity to call our own witnesses or provide a full presentation of the equitable issues in the case, which is Did the parties treat time of the essence? Did they waive that known right? And would it be unconscionable in this case to hold to that contractual provision? That said, all of the parties and the court below treated this as a summary judgment hearing, essentially. There's no disagreement on that. And I believe that the Rule 56 analysis was conducted. So my understanding was that this was proceeding under a de novo review. That said, even if this was an abuse of discretion, we would argue that the court did abuse its discretion by holding that the parties waived their right to treat time of the essence, and by ruling that this would be unconscionable without reviewing all of the facts and without holding that evidence you're hearing. But this is essentially, regardless of the form, a breach of contract case. The purchase agreement contained unambiguous terms regarding...
Mr. Cheskis, before you go forward into that, I'd like to, before we leave this topic, did your client or her attorney in the district court specifically request an evidentiary hearing and make a proffer of testimony that she desired to introduce?
So we absolutely did request an evidentiary hearing. That's in the transcript at the motion hearing and oral argument. I mean, generally, in the probate context, we would have had a hearing set an evidentiary hearing to determine the issues in the probate. Now, in this case, the only issue really was what's going to happen to this asset, to this homestead asset. And the argument on the other side was, well, it's already under contract. We'd like that contract enforced. And our argument was, you can move for actual damages. You can seek the rescission of the contract and get your earnest money back, but your specific performance remedy is precluded. So we never got an evidentiary hearing on when, the parties rescheduled closing for. Was closing going to go through? If it did not go through, did the time lapse to allow specific performance? And if it did the parties waive their right to, or did the parties waive that contractual provision by not treating time of the essence of the actual closing date itself? But to answer your question, Judge, yes, we did request an evidentiary hearing. No, the court did not grant one.
Mr. Cheskis, I'm trying to understand the facts that the judge otherwise didn't receive that you believe your client would have presented to change the results of the judge's order. And in particular, I'm looking at finding number 3 in the judge's order, in which she says, but for the disappearance of Terry McCoy, the transaction likely would have closed on or about June 22. And since we already know that is beyond the 30-day extension, which was allowed in order to clear title, isn't that evidence alone, which the court relied on, that the parties did not treat time of the essence? In other words, that it seems to be undisputed. Hence the basis for summary judgment / whatever it's called in probate court.
Sure. So as we briefed, the extended closing date should have been June 14th. The purchase agreement allowed for the parties to modify that date by agreement. So even if the parties, and that modification should have been in writing, and the allegation here as well, that modification was oral. Now we dispute that, but even if taking the position that, okay, fine, the parties modified the purchase agreement and it should have closed on June 22nd. That is still a time of the essence provision that the parties needed to stick to. So if the parties made a modification to the agreement, we're closing June 22nd. Okay, that is now our drop dead date. That date is now of the essence.
But I'm not sure I understand, though. The point being is obviously, but for his death, according to the court's finding, and that seems consistent with the record we're seeing based on all the affidavits that respondents submitted, it would have closed. So I'm trying to get to what I assume you would agree that you don't have a right to an evidentiary hearing under any scenario, civil or probate, if there are no genuine issues of material fact. So I'm trying to get at what, other than the affidavit, I think your client made reference to prior to the extension to clear title, that he was tired of being nickel and dimed, which I don't read to mean he didn't want to close, but simply he's tired of being nickel and dimed. So what I'm wondering is, what genuine issue of material fact did your client present that we could look to in the record that makes it error for a court to therefore have granted the equivalent of summary judgment?
So first of all, he not only expressed concerns of being nickel and dime, he wavered on whether he would close or not. She also indicated that he had previously backed out of other purchase agreements in the past. So his obligation, if we take the position that closing is set for June 22nd. His obligation was to close on June 22nd, but sellers don't always show up to closing. So once he did not show up to closing for whatever reason, the transaction did not close. And if time was of the essence, which is still a dispute, if time was of the essence, then the clocks, then there's a breach by either party for not closing. So at that point, the clock starts ticking on your 6-month right to seek specific performance under the unambiguous terms of the contract.
At what point exactly? On the date of the scheduled closing?
Correct, Your Honor. So the parties had a scheduled closing. It's June 22nd. That date was of the essence, according, if we concede that the parties correctly modified the agreement. The transaction should have closed on June 22nd. It did not.
So then your position is that the request for specific performance then was required to be made by December 22?
The action for specific performance must have been commenced by December 22nd. Ms. Drewicki did not do that. She, on December 16th, she filed an ex parte motion to be appointed special administrator of the estate. They gave no notice to any interested persons, and the court granted that motion or that petition without notice to anybody.
Mr. Justice, I want to try to clarify then the our discussion, maybe your argument. Is it your position, let's just assume hypothetically, that it's not his death that prevented him from attending on June 22, but an emergency illness, for example. He gets word maybe directly or indirectly to a buyer that I can't close. Unfortunately, I've had an accident. We'll have to do it sometime in August when I'm feeling better. Are you indicating to me that at that point, the buyer would need to sue, or that the clock is still running to sue, even though clearly the parties are agreeing to sell and have on their own orally agreed to a closing date well now past the extension? You're indicating to me that a claim arises, that's the phrase in the contract, that unambiguously means your claim for specific performance arises even before you have your new scheduled closing date where everybody's intending to close.
I would say, Your Honor, that on June 23rd, if respondent no longer wanted to purchase the property, she could have served the seller with a cancellation.
But I'm focusing on the facts we have here. There's, according to the record, there's no dispute that these parties wanted to sell. And so I'm trying to understand your argument about the unambiguous. I'm not so sure how unambiguous that, there's no definition of when a claim arises. But my point being is, your point is, a claim for specific performance 6 months arises as soon as a closing date that was scheduled by agreement does not occur, even though there's a future closing date.
So if the parties modified the agreement, Your Honor, I would agree that a claim has not arisen yet. But that's not this case. The parties did not modify this purchase agreement and set a future closing date.
That's because he died, I assume. I guess my question then is, and you don't make mention of this in your brief, the record's pretty clear that one of his heirs at law, the daughter, who was actively negotiating or talking with the husband of the buyer, said, "We will close. We're going to close." That's what he wanted to do. And I think it's safe to say that that was all the messages until late December. So I'm trying to think of the hypothetical. If the seller himself had not died and was saying all the same things, I'm trying to understand the distinction of why a claim would not arise in that scenario. But you're saying here it arises in June, even though there's no, number one, there's no estate to sue. But number two, the natural heirs are saying, yes, you're going to get it. We're going to close. My what lawyer's working on it.
So a couple things on that, Your Honor. Number one, Ms. McCoy was not the personal representative at the time of these text messages. It very well possible that she could have petitioned to be the PR and her brother would have objected and she would not have, would not have been appointed the personal representative. Number two, those text messages were not made to respondent. They're made to a third party that was not a party to the purchase agreement. But number three, if you parse the text messages, there's no text message from Carrie McCoy saying, yes, I'm going to sell to you under these terms. They start talking about different terms regarding maintenance obligations and other costs incurred. But there's no set closing date. There's no reference to a set price. Yes, she's a natural buyer, right? Because she already previously agreed to buy the property. But there's nothing in those text messages that says we're going to extend the closing date until I'm done grieving, or that I'm selling it to you at $195,700. So at best, these are negotiations for a different sale. If this was Terry McCoy saying that, hey, I got sick and I'm unable to close on June 22nd, but I'll happily close in August, I think that'd be a different case, Sean, and I respectfully reserve the rest of my time.
Very good. Thank you. Counsel for a respondent, you may identify yourself and you may proceed as soon as you see the 15 minutes up on the clock. There we go. You are muted. There we go.
I'm excited there for a second. If it may please the court, my name is Jason Line. I'm the attorney for the respondent, Ruth Ann Sprung, now Drewicki. I don't have a lot to add. The court has clearly considered the briefs, but I do want to respond to a couple of the comments that came up in the questions to Mr. Cheskis and in the responses. We did proceed as though this was summary judgment, and that's why we used the standard review that we did. Obviously, if we were incorrect in the standard review and the standard review is an abuse of discretion, then it's even more clear that the judge's decision is correct. The question that Judge Johnson asked specifically of Mr. Cheskis was, what was the evidence that Ms. McCoy intended to proffer if she had gotten an evidentiary hearing? And we have that evidence in her affidavit. And while Mr. Cheskis says that Terry McCoy had backed out of previous purchase agreements, nowhere in the affidavit of Carrie McCoy does it say that. It says at paragraph 5 that while the property was listed for sale, decedent changed his mind on more than one occasion about whether he wanted to sell the property or not. But it never says that he backed out of a previous purchase agreement. That's just simply not in the record. What I believe Ms. McCoy wants to rely on is paragraph 18, where she states, when I spoke with my father prior to the extended closing date. An extended closing date is capitalized. It is a defined term. If the court looks in Ms. McCoy's brief at page 2, extended closing date is defined as June 14th, 2020. So in this situation, we are talking about one conversation that happened prior to June 14th, 2020, where she talked about that he thought he was being nickel and dimed, and he may have wavered on whether he was going to follow through with the sale of the property. So that's on June 14th. After that, we know very well that Mr. McCoy intended to go forward with the closing. The closing was scheduled. We have the affidavit of Ms. McClare, Marcy LeClaire, that talks about the closing being scheduled. We have the affidavit of Julie Bostrom, the apartment manager in New Effington, South Dakota, where she talks about the week before Mr. McCoy, or the week that Mr. McCoy did disappear, he was talking with her about expressing excitement about going forward with a closing. So we clearly have a waiver by Mr. McCoy of the need to close by June 14th. And the court is precisely correct that had Mr. McCoy not disappeared, this would have closed on June 22nd and we wouldn't be here today. Unfortunately, Mr. McCoy did disappear. And after that, obviously Mr. McCoy is not able to tell us what his thoughts were anymore, but we know from the affidavit of Chandra Rickey and the many, many texts and comments that Ms. McCoy intended to go through. She made it very clear that she intended to go through with the closing. This idea that, oh, this was a different deal and this was going to be renegotiated, that's simply not in the record. What it talks about is Chandra Rickey says, you know, I'm going to continue to maintain the property. And Ms. McCoy says, yep, I'm going to get a probate going and the house is going to be yours, which she never does. And that's why finally in December, despite my client's intent to allow her time to grieve, we can't finally get to the point where we've got to do something to close on this property. And so we started the special administration then because there was nobody appointed as of that date. Ms. McCoy kept saying that she was going to do it. She kept saying that she was talking to her lawyer. She kept saying that the paperwork was going to go in. She kept saying that they couldn't because the death certificate wasn't available yet. She kept representing to us that she was going to go forward and close, but she never did.
Mr. Lina, can I just ask you a point Mr. Cheskis made in reference to the parties, that it's they're now married, as I understand the buyers. Well, she's married to someone, the actual buyer did, but he seemed to focus on the distinction of the communication between Ms. McCoy and her husband. I don't know if he was husband at the time or became husband, but in any event, do you have any response to that in terms of how it affects our review?
I don't think it has any impact at all. I think as the court potentially is well aware, very often you and your spouse jointly work together to you know, say you've got an addition project or some construction project. Sometimes your wife is the one that calls and asks about it. Sometimes you are. I mean, when they entered into the agreement, they were not married yet. They became married subsequently, and clearly it was going to be the family home. So I don't think that makes any difference. I think clearly Ms. McCoy knew that at a minimum, Chandra Rickey was acting as the agent of his wife, Ruth Ann Sprung. And certainly I don't think you can make the argument of this was some separate party that she didn't think that would be communicated on to the actual named contracted party. But, you know, so we submit the special administration, and that's when we get this very nasty email afterwards that says lots of things that I won't repeat here. But it also very clearly says in that email, Ms. McCoy clearly says, this house would have been yours, but for you not giving me time to grieve. So even after we file for the special administration, she still admits that this purchase should have gone through. And while she's very upset, she says the house would have been yours if you'd just given me time to grieve. So I think at that point, that's the first indication that we have that the seller intends to breach the agreement. Up until that point, we have a continuous waiver of the closing date, continuous representations to us that we are going to close. I mean, we've got representations of, I guess I shouldn't be the one dealing with the watershed district about the culvert. You should be. Oh, I talked to the electrician. I guess I shouldn't have done that. You should have. We know that Ms. Dricky's husband said, I'm going to continue to maintain the property. That's what Mr. McCoy would have wanted. You know, I don't know the reason why Ms. McCoy decided to go back on this. I don't know if it's rising housing values that we've seen or what it is. But there just cannot be a legitimate argument that this would have closed on June 22nd had Mr. McCoy not gone missing.
So, Mr. Lina, what specifically do you believe triggered the specific performance 6-month claim to have arisen or arise, I believe is the phrase at what point in this entire process do you believe the clock started ticking on that?
I believe the clock started ticking when Ms. McCoy, for the first time in, I believe it was around December 22nd, says, this house would have been yours, but for, I mean, that's the first time she says, I don't intend to go forward with the sale. That's what starts the clock ticking for specific performance. The court's running a little behind. I don't really have anything to add. I'm certainly willing to entertain any questions your honors may have, but I do think that it's abundantly clear in this case that Judge Dahl was correct, that there simply is no evidence. There's no reason to have an evidentiary hearing. They had the chance to present through affidavit form the evidence that they wanted to present, and the evidence they present makes no difference. It's as to a comment made before the June 14th deadline even came to play. They've provided nothing to show that Mr. McCoy did not intend to go through, and just simply the fact that Ms. McCoy continues to represent that she's going to go forward with the sale. I just think it's incredulous that in the back of her mind, she knew her dad didn't intend to close had he not gone missing.
Mr. Line, I'm unclear, I guess. I mean, are you saying that both parties intended to submit the matter on paper with evidence in the form of affidavits or otherwise? Was that the intention of all parties? Or because I got the sense from Appellant's counsel that there was an express request by her, Ms. McCoy, to have an evidentiary hearing so that she could introduce additional evidence.
I don't doubt that there was that request made, but we also both agree that we were essentially going forward with a summary judgment proceeding. Mr. Cheska said today that he understood it was a summary judgment proceeding. I think delay is a big part of this for Ms. McCoy, that she's trying to delay this in the hopes that my clients will go away. And they may have requested an evidentiary hearing, but I think they also needed to show that there was some reason to have that evidentiary hearing. They clearly tried to do that with the affidavit of Ms. McCoy that they presented, but that affidavit just simply did not provide information that showed that there was a question of fact. You know, you can ask for it, but if you can't show that there's a reason to have the evidentiary hearing, I think the court was correct in proceeding as it did.
What about on the equitable issue of specific performance?
I'll just go for the record, by the way, Judge John Smith did join us now. Thank you.
On the equitable issue of specific performance, is that an issue for which additional evidence is necessary in order to have a fully developed record to allow the district court to make the equitable determination necessary?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I mean, we're talking about real estate. We're talking about a very unique piece of property. There simply isn't a substitute in damages for this piece of property in terms of the equities of it. Ms. McCoy certainly tried to take advantage of the fact that the Drewickies at least thought they were going to buy it by letting Mr. Drewicki continue to perform some maintenance, by telling Mr. Drewicki, I guess you should have been the one that talked to the electrician, by telling Mr. Drewicki, oh, you're the one that should talk to the boy to sue about the culvert. I mean, there's simply, it would be inequitable not to allow the Drewickies to receive the benefit of the bargain they made with Mr. McCoy. And there's no sign of inequity on the part of the Drewickies.
One follow-up of that, Mr. Lina, do you believe the judge did analyze the facts in an equitable fashion to reach its decision? Or if you, maybe I didn't ask that very well, that the standard of review case law I was referring to earlier suggests that when the facts are in dispute, but a judge considers them in an equitable fashion to come to a result, abuse of discretion may be the standard. And it's a little hard for me to tell as I look at the order. The judge did, in its conclusion, I think, use the phrase unconscionable. And I think a finding made a point that there was no sharp practice. But was the court applying those equitable factors or facts in an equitable fashion in its ruling?
I certainly think they were. I mean, I think the court looked at the facts that were before it, and the facts that were before it were, we have a purchase agreement. There were things that had to be done. to make title marketable. Mr. McCoy was clearly doing those things up until June 11th. I mean, the idea that when Mr. McCoy had just made title marketable on June 11th, that we needed to instantly close on June 14th. I mean, that's just unrealistic to how real estate transactions happen, particularly when there's a mortgage involved. I mean, the fact that in the summer of 2020, which if the court will remember, was the very height of COVID, that we finally have these title issues resolved by the 12th of June, and that we have a closing scheduled 10 days later is remarkable, especially when we have the evidence that the appraiser didn't want to go out at one point because Mr. McCoy was 68 years old and he had a case of COVID. I mean, the speed with which they tried to get this closed was very, very good in light of the circumstances. And there's simply nothing in the record that shows it would be inequitable for specific performance not to be granted. The only thing we have is this comment from Ms. McCoy that while he was tired of being nickel and dimed, and he thought about prior to June 14th, not going forward with the transaction, but you know, we know that Mr. McCoy was very excited about this property going through. He wanted the sale to go through before the Turicchi's baby was born. He tells that to Julie Bostrom, and it's in the affidavit. There simply is no evidence that Ms. McCoy presented that not granting specific performance, or I'm saying I've got too many double negatives here, but that it would be inequitable to grant specific performance. She continued to state to this couple that she was going to go through with the sale. She continued to state that it was her dad's wishes. There's simply nothing that would allow the court to find that it would be inequitable to grant specific performance.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. And now counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to focus on the question of whether Mr. McCoy intended to close on this transaction, whether he had a contractual obligation to do so. And if the argument is that he had a contractual obligation to close on June 22nd, the fact is he did not. And then the question becomes, what happens next? Can the buyer seek specific performance? It's very well likely that had the case been brought within 6 months, she could have availed herself of that remedy. But this is not a special provision that the parties drafted. This is boilerplate language in a Minnesota Association of Realtors residential purchase agreement form. This is an extremely common limitation in Minnesota, and it's honored and it's been upheld by this court for many years. Same as when does the cause of action arise? It's been good law for 130 years that performance for the sale of real estate accrues by the terms of the contract when the purchase money was to be paid and the deed delivered. And that's the Lewis v. Pendergrass case and its progeny that we cited. So this specific performance action was required to be commenced by December 22nd. Since it was not, the buyer can cancel the purchase agreement and seek her earnest money back. She can seek actual damages, but the specific performance remedy is no longer available to her. And again, Mr.
Justice, I'm still not fully understanding that. Is why would a buyer sue for specific performance to close a transaction the seller wants to close?
So first of all, this was not the seller. This was the seller's daughter who had no privity of contract with the respondent.
So is it safe? And you brought that up a couple times. So there would be no one to sue anyway if a buyer had an obligation to sue for specific performance. Is your point? And she's the heir who then we, as we know, became the personal representative. So it was a pretty good advice for the buyers to communicate with her. And she, it looks like clearly from the record, she was holding herself out as having some authority and we will close. I'm talking to my lawyers. We will close. I'm talking to my lawyers. So I'm trying to get at that point of a claiming arise. As long as a buyer and seller continue to reschedule a closing date and there's no evidence that a either party does not wish to follow through, why would someone have a basis to sue for specific performance of a contract that the other side's performing?
So the buyer could have made a creditor claim in the probate for, you know, a special to be appointed to review the purchase agreement, which she ultimately attempted to do, although it was ex parte. You know, but again, there was no guarantee that Ms. McCoy would be appointed the personal representative or that she would ultimately get authority to execute this transaction, and, or that ultimately she had to execute this transaction. I mean, once she talks to a lawyer and learns of her legal rights with her fiduciary obligation to protect the interest of the estate and its heirs, that's exactly what she does. But the fact of the matter is the sale does not close. The buyer then starts talking to not the seller, but somebody who may have authority in the future. And there's no specific reference in these text messages to selling on these terms. And in fact, if the court takes judicial notice of the affidavit filed by Ms. McCoy in the first appeal, the court will see that the price was an issue, that the decedent actually thought he was getting $30,000 more for this property than what the purchase agreement stated. And there's affidavits to that effect. And that may have well been a reason, which we could have flushed out at an evidentiary hearing, why Ms. McCoy says in her affidavit that, hey, you know, dad may not have wanted to sell this property to them because when he realized what the terms were, they may have differed from what his understanding was of it. But we never got a chance to make that record, never got a chance to cross-examine the affidavit witnesses that Mr. Lina brought. Ms. McCoy never got to testify about those actual conversations with her father, whether or not he legitimately would have showed up and closed this transaction. Again, sellers do not close transactions for whatever reason, often in Minnesota. And then the question is what happens once they fail to show up for closing and once a closing is not rescheduled, once there is no written modification, which is another good reason why the statute of frauds exists to prevent these type of oral continuations.
Very good. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing and answers to our questions, and we will be taking the matter under advisement, and we will now proceed to the second of three oral arguments, and you each have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honor.